Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. My name is BJ CSL, class of 2007, and I'm here today with Molly O'Toole, class of 2009. Molly is an immigration and security reporter based in the Los Angeles Times, Washington, D.C. Bureau. Previously, she was a senior reporter at Foreign Policy, covering the 2016 election and Trump administration, a politics reporter at the Atlantic's Defense One, and a news editor at the Huffington Post. She has covered migration and security from Mexico, Central America, West Africa, the Middle East, the Gulf, and South Asia for The Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, The New Republic, Newsweek, The Associated Press, and many other publications. She was awarded the first ever Pulitzer Prize in audio reporting in 2020 with the staff of This American Life and freelancer Emily Green for The Out Crowd, investigating the personal impact of the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy on asylum officers and asylum seekers. She's a graduate of Cornell University in NYU, but of course will always be a Californian. Welcome to the podcast, Molly O'Toole.
Thanks for having me.
Excited to have you. I know you've always been a Californian. You like to put avocados and talk about Taco Tuesdays more than I can possibly imagine. That's one of my favorite memories, hanging out with you. This being a Cornell podcast, I'll just start off right away with our favorite Cornell stuff. My very first question for you is, when did you first fall in love with Cornell?
Oh my gosh. I actually fell in love with Cornell on my very first visit. I actually ran track at Cornell and I had come out early to visit. And it was really the first time I'd ever been on what I refer to as the East Coast, even though Ithaca is nowhere close to the coast. And I thought the campus was so beautiful. I just fell in love with it. And this was even during fall break. So campus was basically a ghost town. And even though I was convinced there weren't any students actually at this university, I loved the campus so much that I basically had already decided right then that that's where I wanted to go.
Could it be that because there was no one there that you loved it that much more?
Actually, the coaches were concerned that because I'm from Southern California, they wanted to make sure that I was prepared, mentally prepared for the winter. So they actually, I came back again for a visit in February, just so they made sure that, because I guess they'd had Southern Californians or other people from Hawaii, other places who'd come and had gotten so freaked out by the winter that they ended up leaving. So they wanted to make sure, but it's one of the first times I'd ever seen snow.
Oh, really?
And I loved it. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so it made me love it even more, actually.
I think it's, but you know, I was a resident advisor for a while and I always remember the first snow from like the Southern or the West Coast kids. And it's like the first snow in Ithaca, it's like, oh, they're so excited. And then, you know, 2 weeks into the Ithaca winter and prelims, they're like, I hate this place. I will fly away, never return. So I get where your coaches were coming from at that point.
I still love it to this day. I feel like Ithaca gave me a love of winter. I know that sounds insane, but it's still sort of novel to me. And it's such a beautiful place, like all seasons, that I still love winter because of that. Although my Midwest friends do make fun of me.
I love it. So, you know, you talk about loving Ithaca and going back there. Where is the place that you always have to go to when you are back in Ithaca?
Oh boy. There's so many, but actually I think probably one that I always have to go back to is, we called it Second Dam. I'm not sure what other people called it, but basically it was up the road. And it was one of the best swimming spots at Cornell, where you would gorge jump and go swimming and we'd have picnics. And I associate in the rare moments and of months of nice weather. And that's a place that we always go back to. It always felt kind of magical and secret, even though it definitely wasn't. But I think that's probably a place I always have to revisit. That and the Harry Potter Library, which of course is not called, which is of course not called the Harry Potter Library, but I spent so many hours in that library and I just love it.
That kind of answers my second question as well too. So the A.D. White Library is the one you're referring to. Do you have a favorite go-to study spot when you're a student?
Mine was A.D. White. I know it's a lot of people's, but if I could claim one of those desks, or especially one of the couch spots that sort of overlooks the slope and the lake, that was my absolute favorite place. Or occasionally going up those spiral staircases, if you could get one of those desks sort of on one of the landings.
Oh, but
definitely, it's got to face the slope though, and it has to face the lake, so you can sort of remind yourself that there's still beauty in this world, even though you have hours and hours and hours of studying left to do.
Just that ray of hope, I guess, from the bleak Ithaca sun sky right there too. What's your favorite go-to campus eatery?
This is going to be so controversial. I feel like this is the most difficult of all the questions. I also think that there are a few that I used to eat at that are no longer there. There was actually a really wonderful sandwich like stand that used to be in, it used to be basically overlooking that terrace that's above the Ivy Room that basically like no one uses that terrace. Yep. Or they, and I don't know even if the sandwich stand had a name, but they made the most delicious sandwiches. They were fantastic. There were only like a few seats. There was only like, I think there were only like a few seats inside, and there was like maybe 6 or 7 seats on the terrace, which was closed most of the year. But they actually had the best sandwiches out of, I think, anywhere on campus. And I stand by that, even if I don't remember the name.
I know exactly the place you're talking about. It's gotten several names over the years. I'm trying to think of what it might currently be called now. But yeah, it was good. I liked it because, as you said too, it's right by that terrace. So you could just go right outside in the nice months and just sit out there and enjoy a delicious break between the day.
Exactly.
So my other two questions, what's your most overrated campus spot and the most underrated campus spot?
I did not understand why people were so obsessed with the Statler. And those burritos, they're like, and I love me some burritos. I consider myself.
A lot of
myself,
angry hotelies are going to write alumni affairs now.
I know. And I consider myself to be a burrito connoisseur. And so, you know, I don't turn down a good burrito. I never would. I mean, that's blasphemy. But the Statler, I always thought that the Statler was overrated. It didn't feel like very hospitable. It felt like you're sort of eating in a bunker. It just sort of felt like you were eating like, oh boy, I won't even go there. Yes, the Statler, I feel like, was the most overrated for me personally.
Okay. And the most underrated spot on campus?
For eating?
Anything.
Oh, underrated spot on campus for anything?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I feel like people never spend enough time in the plantations. They're far. But the whole campus is huge. So if you're walking that far anyway, just keep going and just sort of like escape into the beautiful wilds that is the plantations. I mean, you could lose yourself there for hours and hours and hours, all of these little paths. And it's so rare. I think we didn't even realize, because the campus is so beautiful, I think we didn't even realize how lucky we were to have this endless property and agricultural area, gardens to wander through. For better or for worse, a lot of the exposure I had to that was because I was a runner. And so we had to sort of keep inventing new runs for ourselves to not go insane with all the miles we were putting in. But it did give me an insight into the plantations and just some of Cornell's like broader grounds that I think a lot of students don't really access ever.
Yeah. I mean, I think I appreciate that spot too. I grew up in Wisconsin, as you know, so like outdoors things are a really big thing for me. So the Arboretum, I think, is what the Newman Arboretum is right north of campus. It's probably what most people think of as they think of, well, what's now known as the Cornell Botanic Gardens as well too. So beautiful spot. I think it's one of those things, you know, Cornell is much more than just the main campus than people know about. How do you spend your time exploring beyond that as well too? So my last kind of Cornell-y question for you. So if you got to create a new class at Cornell, what would it be and why?
Oh, it would be, oh my gosh, it would be, it would, oh God. I think it would be literary journalism.
Okay.
There are classes that touch on journalism. There are classes that touch on nonfiction. There are classes that sort of touch on narrative nonfiction. But as you know, and I, you know, somewhat unwisely found out sort of belatedly, Cornell doesn't have a journalism program, which in the end, I think is actually wonderful because it has the Cornell Daily Sun, which is independent of the university, very importantly, and is a real newspaper. I mean, it's the biggest newspaper in Ithaca, no offense to Ithaca. And that's a real education. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But Cornell doesn't actually have a journalism program. Lately, they launched a really awesome initiative with Mark Lacey, who's the national editor for the New York Times, and he was the editor-in-chief of the Cornell Daily Sun. And they're going to sort of have a visiting journalist program that I think is going to do some they'll do some lectures around journalism, which I think is really cool. But literary journalism is such an amazing genre of literature. And I think that would be such a cool class to teach and to take. I would like want to go back and take that class.
Yeah. Maybe you can guest lecture at that too. So, I think that's a natural shift for us. Just talking about your work and career now. You recently won a Pulitzer Prize in audio journalism. Congratulations. That's super cool. I think you're the inaugural winner of that along with the staff of This American Life. How would you describe your career to someone you've just never met before?
Oh, wow. Very rambling. I graduated from Cornell in 2009, sort of right at the height of the Great Recession. And I had already been told for years, actually, that journalism was not a practical career, that it was not a stable industry to try and enter as a young person or as any person. But as a result, sort of my entirety of my journalism career being sort of during this incredibly tumultuous time for journalism as an industry, it's also forced a lot of innovation in journalism. And so I've had this really wide range of journalism jobs, which is not very traditional. So I've worked at sort of, I guess what you might consider the sort of cutting edge, wild, wild west of digital media, where I put the Huffington Post on that end of the spectrum. I've worked for some like real journalistic institutions, sort of more academic, like Foreign Policy Magazine or The Atlantic. I've also worked for wire services, which most people aren't that familiar with, but basically the people who get it first and get it out really quickly, like the Associated Press and Reuters. And actually the Los Angeles Times is the first newspaper I've worked for since the Cornell Daily Sun, which is sort of funny. So I've worked in all different kinds of media, and I've also had a lot of journalism jobs, which is not how it used to be. You'd work at, maybe 1, 2, 3 publications for your whole career. You'd stay there for 15 years. You might work your way up from a reporter to be an editor, maybe to be a manager. There was sort of a very traditional path that you followed, and basically that path no longer exists. So that's a long-winded way to explain my career to someone I didn't know. I guess more or less what I would tell them is I've had a lot of different journalism jobs at all different aspects of the industry, but all of which I think and I hope has made me better at what I do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's reflected in a lot of the reporting that you've done as well, too. I think one thing that I heard you talk about, too, is how you've kind of spanned different sectors from, the cutting edge of digital journalism to more traditional papers and whatnot. I think, the common adage is, traditional media is changing, right? And I think you have grown up your career through that change as well, too. Looking back on it, what do you think are some of the standout changes that you've seen from being first a consumer of media and I think then participating and growing your career through it?
I mean, some of these changes were already, they're really seismic changes, and they were already taking place, sort of even as I was entering Cornell and throughout Cornell, because I worked, I had internships and I had journalism experience throughout Cornell as well. Besides the Daily Sun, I had, internships during the summer and that sort of thing. I mean, the biggest is the real shift in the way people consume news from print to digital. But beyond that, even from like your desktop to your phone. And there are sort of these different generations of, so not just the shift from print to digital, which is what I think how we sort of categorize it a lot, but then within digital, this sort of shift from, your AOL landing page to your, to your phone, to people consuming a lot of their news through social media platforms. I mean, these were really seismic shifts that happened, and they most of them sort of predated or were simultaneous with when I was really starting my career. Yeah. In journalism, and I think this expectation that that news should be free because everything online is free. Look at all this content that I can access just at the click of a button. And that was a real fundamental shift as well. I mean, the polarization of media. It's interesting because there was sort of the yellow, you know, the yellow journalism, even when Pulitzer himself actually was alive and kicking. Thank you, Pulitzer Prize Board. I don't mean any disrespect. You know, that actually was a really political era of journalism, and and credibility was not necessarily always at the forefront. There was a lot of sort of sensationalism to sell papers. And so it's not as if political, the journalism being political is new. But I think the polarization that we see, and I experienced this, I think, also in a very visceral way because I'm an immigration reporter, which is such a polarizing issue in this country. Uniquely, and it is a polarizing issue beyond this country, but I think sort of uniquely, you know, it's a fundamental debate about what America means.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I think it's more polarizing. So that was a long-winded answer, of course, again, but lots of changes. Yeah.
And I think, so what I appreciate, I think, about doing this podcast is we're able to take people that are currently working in these fields and just, you know, learn a little bit more. And so I think the things that you described are looking from the outside, right? Like that all makes sense. I think just a casual consumer hears about a lot of those topics. What is something that you think just a casual person doesn't understand that they might get wrong a little bit, that you working in the industry might be able to help correct some views in that space?
I think a lot of people don't understand how hard the job is. And I don't say that like, oh, poor us. I mean, I think we are so lucky to do what we do. I feel really lucky to do what I do. I feel like I tricked someone somewhere where I get this job, that's sort of just endlessly fun and I'm never bored. It's extremely difficult for a few reasons. And I can only speak to sort of my personal experience, but I'll mention two ways. You know, I cover immigration and national security. And to the extent that I can, I try and focus on policy and not politics. And then how that policy sort of translate it to people by showing them how that policy affects real people's lives, not just sort of, you know, old white guy in a suit in Washington who's got some title that's, you know, 10 words long and what he thinks about the policy because he wrote it. But no, the person who's on the other end of that policy, I think that's really the best way we can sort of measure or understand how those policies impact people. But it also leads you to speak to a lot of people at some of the lowest moments in their lives, you know, where they really are in a life or death situation, which for, you know, many immigrants is the case, both inside the country and outside the country. And in order to try and do as much justice to those stories as you can, you get pretty deep into them, which is not to say that you're no longer objective, but it's just actually a necessary part of translating that experience for other people is trying to get as deep into it as you can. And you end up taking on a lot of people's trauma. There's sort of a secondary trauma. And there've been plenty of, this is not just sort of my personal experience anymore. There've been plenty of studies that look at this. And I think it's something that journalists don't talk about enough because we want to portray ourselves as sort of these really tough, thick-skinned reporters, and they don't take any shit. I don't know if I can curse on this podcast, but you know, don't take any shit from anybody. And we don't want to let ourselves appear vulnerable because we do have to be tough to do our jobs. But it's a huge part of what we do is you are impacted. You do sort of take on other people's difficulties in their lives. And that's really tough, especially when my second thing that I would highlight, you know, right now, regardless of your political opinions, and I'm not entitled to have any as a journalist, and I think that's important to be as objective as possible. You know, the president frequently talks about how the media is an enemy of the people. And there have been very real, you know, threats against journalists, but also there's a major and rising growing problem with misinformation. And so the truth is sort of no longer the truth, or maybe it's your truth, but it's not my truth. And that's really difficult. It's really difficult to do our jobs in that context, especially when sometimes the very people who you're trying to hold accountable, because that's a fundamental part of your job, it's a public service in that way, they're actually blocking your access to important information at the same time as they're knocking you for using anonymous sources, even though they're the anonymous sources because they've demanded anonymity in order to give you access to the information you need in order to hold the government accountable. And I think that's an aspect of our jobs that a lot of people don't understand. And I think that we're obligated to be more transparent about just how difficult it is to get information to share with them.
I mean, I think I had a colleague that was actually going to library sciences, and I started laughing. I'm like, library sciences, like, what's happening there? And they're like, really, it's a lot about how we enter an information age and we just talk about that, but we don't talk about how it's a volume of information and how do we both enter this age and we shift through information, better analyze, you know, what is considered good sources of information and how do we just navigate the deluge of information that we get nowadays as well too. And I think, you know, I agree with you, like that's where journalism and reporting really has a huge role to play in just giving us, you know, when we're bombarded with 20 billion things in a day, what are the things that I should really be paying attention to? And what are the things that matter to us coming forward? So it's crazy. I think I always like to ask the kind of the future of your space too. So keeping all that in mind, keeping the context of just kind of our changing media landscape, the stuff that you're talking about as well, where do you see the future of investigative reporting kind of moving towards?
Oh boy. I mean, one of the things that's actually heartening to me is sort of no matter what form it takes, whether in this circumstance, I was lucky enough to work in audio, which I don't have in basically long form investigative radio reporting, which is not a medium that I have really been able to work with in any serious way before. And that can do things that any of my stories could never do, because you're working with people's literal words, the sound of their voice, the sounds of a refugee camp, for example. And I can only come so close to describing that. It's totally different for people to be able to hear it. But I think the encouraging thing for me is no matter what form investigative reporting takes, whether it's the sort of old school written word, a long form podcast piece, which is so hugely popular right now and has really exploded. And that sort of genre or that medium is really being pushed to these sort of amazing new heights as technology enables us to do that, to expand in all these other forms of the way that people consume information. What's encouraging to me is sort of the future. In some ways, the future is the past. The fundamentals of investigative reporting are the same as they always have been. It's about, you know, trying to find information that the powers that be are trying to keep from the public, and to shine a light on that so that they can be held accountable and the public's right to know, and trying to get people to talk to you who really don't want to talk to you or who are afraid to talk to you, sort of sleuthing out sources and getting a hold of documents and papers in order to sort of really build the sort of statistical or the data behind the story that you're trying to tell. I mean, all of that is sort of always has been, and I think always will be, a fundamental part of reporting. That's why people have seen it not just as something to consume, but as like a fundamental part of democracy, a fundamental part of the fabric of our country. There's a reason. And I think that that will continue to be true, but maybe that is just naive or optimistic of me, or a little bit self-preserving, because I'd like to have a job. Naive.
Yeah. Wouldn't we all as well too? But I mean, I think it's true, right? Like what you mentioned before too, I think is true, in that a lot of this just kind of goes back full circle in a lot of ways, right? I had someone, I forgot who it is now too, but they're like, I don't really like radio, but I do like podcasts. And I found that just to be a fascinating thing to say, because aren't podcasts essentially just a different form of storytelling, right, at the end of the day, right? Like radio serials, that podcast serial, actually, to go back in that form as well, too. It's just everything old is new again, right? And I think that's these things are more important now than ever. I want to go back a little bit, you know, just to dig in, talk a little bit about how your piece came together. Again, it's called The Outcrowd. You did it in partnership with This American Life. Could you talk a little bit how, you know, how did this story kind of form? How did you get together with This American Life? What's the story there?
Right. Well, I actually joined the LA Times fairly recently in December of 2018. And I'd always done reporting in one way or another on migration or national security. So this was an awesome job for me. But very early on, even before I joined the LA Times, I've been doing some work even before that. I mean, really looking at the fundamental ways in which the Trump administration was transforming U.S. immigration, the U.S. immigration system. And one of the most interesting things to me was especially sort of trying to measure the Trump administration's, or President Trump, his sort of promises in the campaign against some of the early steps he was taking on immigration, is the way that they were targeting legal immigration. Now, we like to put immigration in these categories, you know, legal, illegal, good, bad, the sort of good, you know, quote unquote, good migrant. This is not my, I'm using this just for the purposes of example, good migrant, bad migrant, you know, refugee, good, economic migrant, bad. I mean, there's sort of these categories that we like to put it in, but in a lot of ways, the Trump administration was targeting legal immigration, so immigration that's permitted by U.S. law, as opposed to illegal immigration that is not, and in what has often been a sort of political target by both parties, but, you know, primarily, at least in sort of modern American politics, by the Republican Party. Anyway, so one of the most interesting parts of this for me, especially having experience reporting in Mexico and being from San Diego, which really is a border town, was this remain in Mexico policy. That's sort of the easiest way to understand it, what most people know it by, but the official term is the Migrant Protection Protocols, which is the most ironic of all names. And it's this policy by which always before, when someone came to the U.S. border, they actually have a right under U.S. law to claim asylum. It doesn't mean you're going to get it, and actually very few people do, but you have the right to seek asylum, to seek protection in the United States. And every other administration primarily would let people wait while they go through this process through the immigration court system in the United States. So for the first time ever, the Trump administration was actually pushing people back to Mexico in order to wait out these hearings. And it was happening very, very quickly in a large number of people. But because they were sort of waiting in these Mexican border cities, a lot of the American public didn't really realize that this was happening. And it really was one of the most significant of the policies the Trump administration had undertaken. So I started doing a lot of reporting around that. And along the way, it's even hard to sort of piece back together now, but I sort of stumbled on one asylum officer, one federal asylum officer, who sort of tried to help me understand how this worked, the process of seeking asylum and what their job is. And they screen these claims basically to make sure that the U.S. isn't sending someone back to their home country to be killed or harmed. And that's a really fundamental rule in U.S. law, international law. And then that asylum officer led me to another asylum officer who led me to another one, who led me to another one. And sort of before I knew it, I sort of had this, you know, group of asylum officers who tried to help me understand this policy, but were very, very torn by their own experience and their own role in this policy. And through that reporting, I had published a pretty big investigative piece and was contacted shortly after, just like sort of a cold email. This was not someone I knew prior, by the managing editor at This American Life, which is a podcast that I love just as a consumer of journalism. So I was so excited. And they wanted to work together because they'd sort of been trying to do something similar around asylum officers and around the idea of asylum and the way it was changing. That's a really long-winded answer for sort of how for how we got started, but we really started from scratch together, which was also really interesting to sort of go through the whole reporting process, but sort of being forced to think about radio, not just print, which was a totally new experience for me.
What were some of the things that you know, primarily you've been a print journalist before, what do you think was really different about how you adapted this story and your background reporting immigration for an audio medium?
Well, one of the trickiest things is that especially, I mean, it's been true of many administrations, but especially under the Trump administration, there are a lot of people who feel that they cannot speak freely because they will be retaliated against, especially people who are part of the administration. So a lot of my sourcing a lot of times requires anonymity. And we try and be very selective about anonymity. We only give it under very unique circumstances. There has to be like a physical harm that requires it. We have very high standards for that because you don't want to abuse anonymity and just give it to anyone who doesn't really need it and sort of let them, you know, talk shit about someone else but not use their real name. I mean, that sort of thing. You have to be very strict about anonymity.
Yeah.
And a lot of my sources are anonymous, but you can do that in print. But when you need someone's voice for radio, how do you maintain their anonymity?
Yeah.
So that was a like one of the most fundamental challenges of sort of translating the reporting that I do to radio. And This American Life is, they're amazing. They're radio magicians. I wish anyone could sort of sit in on one of their, the way they put an episode together. They're just so incredible at what they do. But, you know, they had dealt with anonymous sources before. And so we sort of came up with what we felt was, and what we hoped was the best way to handle that. And it basically was, you can't use their real voices because then they'll be identifiable.
Yeah.
But you also, it's very emotional, which is why a lot of the asylum officers wanted to speak, essentially blow the whistle on this policy, because they felt it was not just legally wrong. And many of them are lawyers who understand immigration law in a way that I never will be able to.
Yeah.
But they felt it was morally wrong. And they felt like they, and I'm not being over dramatic here, I mean, they felt like they had blood on their hands. But so how do you capture that emotion when you know you can't use their own voice? And so what we ended up doing in the end is there were actors that read, that ended up reading, for the two asylum officers that were anonymous, there were actors that ended up reading their words, and they had listened to them and tried to recreate the emotion of their words as close as they could. And it's actually incredible if you were to hear the difference between the two. They're almost identical. It's hard to tell the difference. But that was a really fundamental challenge that we just sort of figure out between radio and print, and especially sort of investigative reporting in both mediums.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I listened to it when it first came out, and I think, you know, that's, as you just mentioned too, like hearing the emotion in the voice just carries a different weight to reading someone's words as well too. And I think, and especially in a story as personal as immigration, right? These are people, not just, you know, numbers, that carries such a different weight and just, I don't want to say magic, but it's a little bit more just real in a different way. I guess I'm also searching for the right word that is there too, but the podcast really just kind of transports you into the real, like, tough ethical moral dilemma that a lot of these officers really face on a day-to-day basis. So not surprised that this podcast won some awards. I thought it was really great, and I highly encourage those out there to give it a listen as well too.
Actually, if I could just say, I'm not sure when this podcast in and of itself is airing, which maybe I shouldn't say, but This American Life is re-airing the episode this week. So,
oh, wow.
So you can take a listen. I mean, you can take a listen in the archives whenever you want, but that's actually going to be the episode of This American Life this week. They're going to re-air the Out Crowd. So.
Oh, look at that. There's a little bit of a delay on these podcasts. I won't air the same week, but at least folks can know they can listen to it on This American Life archives as well too. So that's super awesome. So kind of just, you know, winding back down here, bringing it back to Cornell. I mean, I could talk to you about, you know, your work, your career, and immigration in general. You know this as we've spent many nights chatting about this kind of stuff just on a personal level. But just kind of thinking about, you know, Cornell's impact with you as well too. So, you know, you're a young alumna, you just won a Pulitzer Prize. You know, thinking back to when you were a student, is this really where you thought you'd be kind of in this point in your life and your career?
I mean, I think you've said that phrase a few times during this podcast, and I still think you're talking about someone else. Like, it just can't, it's so surreal for me still. And the answer is hell no, no. You know, I've told a few people this over the last couple of days, but I mean, maybe in my wildest journalistic ambitions that I secretly held and didn't tell anyone about for fear that they might laugh at me, I was hoping that, you know, maybe one day I'd be like a little footnote on a Pulitzer citation with, you know, a team of 20 other people, you know, and that maybe that might happen to me. I might be lucky enough for that to happen by the end of my career. So this is not where I thought I would be. I mean, even the job that I have now at the LA Times, I mean, which is not to say, you know, I'm proud and I've worked really hard to get where I am. And I've had a lot of different jobs in journalism. I've been through a lot of shit in journalism, like a lot of people in my generation of journalism have. You know, people who graduated around the same time from Cornell as I did in 2008, 2009, you know, 2007. And now we're facing another recession yet again in the middle of a global pandemic. But all of which is to say, no, I didn't think this is where I would be. It's so much, if it was ever going to happen, which I, of course, you know, hoped that and dreamed that it might. I think a lot of journalists have that ambition. I mean, it's the Pulitzer Prizes. But no, it's so much earlier than I could have ever expected. But if anything, I think it's a real tribute to, I mean, the uniqueness of this category of audio reporting. I mean, it's the first time ever that audio reporting has, a Pulitzer for audio reporting has been given, which may come as some surprise to people, especially people who are in this sort of podcast obsessed generation. I mean, for a lot of people, this is actually how they consume their news. And it really is such an art form. I think there's such an art to it, a beauty to it, like you were describing. And This American Life has always been at the forefront of that. I mean, This American Life sort of invented the podcast. I mean, you referred to Serial at one point. Serial is a spinoff from This American Life.
Yep.
Planet Money, which so many people listen to, that actually, Planet Money came about because of an episode on the Great Recession that came out of This American Life. So if anything, I think it's a tribute to the vision of This American Life and seeing what audio reporting could be. But I think also part of the way it came so much earlier in my career than I might've expected is also sort of speaks to just how much journalism is changing, but how much innovation there is. And it's producing really great journalism, even though it's hard. And I think that the prize in and of itself in this category is a tribute to that. And so I think there's also a reason perhaps that it came so much earlier than I could have ever hoped or dreamed.
I mean, I think you talk about it too. It's, I think sometimes people see, you know, your name, that team, and it's also helping recognize that this didn't just happen overnight, right? And it's also, there's a whole team and it's a creative vision that kind of comes around it as well too. You know, I ask a lot of these questions because I think as students, we were constantly surrounded by like cool people doing cool things. It's very much a culture of, who is doing the most things, who is staying up the latest, getting involved in all these clubs. And I think it's just, it's hard to imagine not being in that rat race and seeing other, you know, you're constantly comparing yourself to others, I think as well too. And I bring that up because I think in the Cornell alumni sphere, you often think about how do you both recognize, you know, everyone else's greatness and see the greatness that other people are participating in, but also be very comfortable with the greatness that you yourself own in that space. You know, how have you kind of grappled with that, you know, before you won this Pulitzer, now recognizing that other people are recognizing your great work too?
Oh boy. I mean, it's tough. I mean, I still, I think Cornell can be an extremely humbling place for a lot of people. I know it was for me. You know, that was also like sort of viscerally drilled into me anytime I had a track meet, when everyone else is just sort of faster than you. You're surrounded by so many brilliant people all the time. And it is really hard not to compare yourself to other people. I will say, I think one of the best aspects of my experience at Cornell, that was really healthy, was the Cornell Daily Sun. And I say that because you're a group of people working together to put out a newspaper every day. And what you realize very quickly, even as, you know, sort of early 20-year-olds, is that everybody has a skill to contribute toward that goal. And so it sort of gave me the space to realize what I was good at and what I wasn't, and that it's okay not to be good at things. And it's okay to own the things that you are good at. And I think it's important to do both. This is sounding more like a sort of like couch therapy session now, but, I was blissfully able to learn that lesson early in a journalism environment that was really healthy, because a lot of times journalism feels like another Cornell, in which you're sort of constantly comparing yourself to other people all the time, especially with this sort of 24/7 news cycle where you can never kind of keep up, and, you know, and the Twitter, you know, world, and, you know, people with these sort of mass followings, and all of that, this sort of journalistic influencers, which is kind of a thing that's terrifying sometimes. Anyways,
concept of like influencers in general, I'm like, what is an influencer? How is that different than just, you know, like a reporter or, you know, an interview? Like, why influencer?
I mean, I hope to God the difference is that we're actually like sort of creating something. Yeah. I think people forget that we do. They sort of pick up a newspaper or read an online article and they just sort of like scroll right past the name. You sort of like forget that there are people behind this that actually make this thing. But so that's all a really long-winded way to say, you know, I still haven't quite figured out what to do with the fact that I am now a Pulitzer winner. All I can say is that there were a lot of people who helped me get here. There was a lot of hard work that went into it. And if anything, it just motivates me to try and to do better and to do more and to hope that there's many, many years ahead of me, with Pulitzers or without Pulitzers. I mean, the work is important. The work's important. And that's really what keeps me going.
I love it. You know, you talk about, again, the other people that kind of help support you. What are some ways that you currently give back to others in your field, to other students?
Oh, I hope I don't sound like a real jerk here and that I don't give back enough at all. But I've tried to become even more involved, and I want to be more involved. If any Sunnies are listening, I really want to be involved with helping young journalists. I mean, there's so much that I wish someone had told me about getting into this industry or journalism sort of as a practice, as a profession. And I want to help young journalists navigate that, because it is it's a scary time. It can be a really unstable industry as a profession, as a way of life. So I really want to help young journalists through that. And I do try and do that as much as I can. And I'm fairly involved with The Sun, but I'd love to be involved even more.
You have our platform now. What would you tell budding young journalists at Cornell right now that you wish you would have known when you were their age?
I guess I would have told them to try and get as much journalism experience as early as possible. Like, you don't have to wait until you graduate to get journalism experience. And Cornell Daily Sun is real life journalism. But I would have told them, don't go to law school. I would have told them, don't listen to the people who tell you that journalism isn't viable, that you can't go into journalism, there is no place for you, that there is no job for you. I would have told them, man, all of that. I would have told them, to absolutely 1000% take a language and stick to it. My Spanish is still not where it needs to be, and
it's pretty good though. I have some
bitterness that Cornell University did not allow me to study abroad in Spain. to this day, no, I'm only half kidding. Yeah, there's so many things I wish I would have told them, or somebody would have told me, and I just don't. Yeah, I don't want them to have to make some of the same mistakes that I did. But then again, there's not a lot I would take back.
Always an adventure, I say. If there's anything I know about you, you do love a good adventure. So for the listeners out there, I have hosted Molly on a few adventures, and she's also taken me on a few kind of around the world as well, too. What's not noted in my intro for her in the bio is that she did spend, were you abroad for like a year, right? Just kind of living abroad in Nepal, Nigeria, a few other places.
Yeah, almost 2 years, which is... It was sort of a backwards way to do it. I mean, some people early on start their career, especially if they're interested in foreign policy or foreign correspondence, you know, they're very brave and they sort of send themselves abroad to live that life and do that journalism. And I was always sort of chicken, and I also had a lot of student debt. Thanks, Cornell, also. And NYU. And so I didn't do that. And I didn't do freelancing. I always had a staff job. And so I sort of did it backwards, where in 2017, after the election, I helped cover the election. I was the only campaign correspondent and the first one that Foreign Policy Magazine had ever had in 2016, which was a hell of a presidential election to cover. Yep. But after that, I decided that if I wanted to continue writing about foreign policy, I was always going to be sort of limited if I didn't spend, you know, a significant amount of time outside of the United States, looking at how that U.S. policy impacts people around the world. Yeah. And so I sort of just sent myself, which is really hard to do. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. But but it was also amazing. I got to tell all these stories and report in these places that I never would have been able to go because of sort of the economics of foreign reporting. Right now, and that is absolutely critical to what I do on a day-to-day. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just something to be said. Knowing something and experiencing something just give you a whole different perspective on it. And especially, I think in your work, it's you can tell the story in just a very different way. And I really appreciate all the work I think that you do around that, and the authentic voice I think that you bring to your reporting as well too.
Thanks, Peach.
I don't have any, this is kind of wrapping up the end of our hour here. We try and keep it close to our time here. So I want to thank Molly O'Toole, class of 2009, for joining us. Again, you can catch her podcast. It's called The Outcrowd, published along with This American Life. Recently won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Audio Reporting, the first award given for this field as well, too. Thanks again, Molly, for joining us. Thank you for listening. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more about Young Alumni programs and how to get involved at alumni.cornell.edu/young-alumni and by following our Facebook page, Cornell Young Alumni Programs. Music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013, and you can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. Have questions or ideas about this podcast? Email our amazing producer, Amanda, at amanda.massa@cornell.edu. Thanks again for listening. My name again is BJ Siasoko, class of 2007, and look forward to visiting you again here at Fresh from the Hill.